This season of The Francis Effect is sponsored in part by Franciscan Media, seeking to spread the gospel in the spirit of St. Francis. Franciscan Media publishes books by authors like Richard Rohr, Heather King, and Ronald Rollheiser. Get 25% off your first order in the store when you use the code FrancisFX, that's Francis, the letter F and the letter X, at franciscanmedia.org. That's franciscanmedia.org. This season of The Francis Effect is brought to you by Liturgical Press in Collegeville, Minnesota. Liturgical Press is a trusted publisher of resources on liturgy, scripture, theology, and spirituality, evolving to serve the changing needs of the Christian church. They produce resources for pastoral leaders, teachers, engaged learners, and all readers looking for quality books on faith and culture. Lit Press books are available at your favorite book retailer and online at litpress.org. That's litpress.org. Hello, and welcome to the Francis Effect Podcast. My name is David Dalt. I host a radio show called Things Not Seen about culture and faith, and I'm an assistant professor of Christian spirituality at the Institute of Pastoral Studies at Loyola University, Chicago. I'm here with my friends Heidi Schlumpf and Father Dan Horan. Heidi is senior correspondent at National Catholic Reporter, a publication that connects Catholics to church, faith, and the common good with independent news, analysis, and spiritual reflection. Father Dan is professor of philosophy, religious studies, and theology, and director of the Center for the Study of Spirituality at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. He's also affiliated professor of spirituality at the Oblate School of Theology in San Antonio, Texas. Every couple of weeks, we get together to discuss news and events through a lens of our shared Catholic faith, although I want to flag right here at the beginning of the episode that this is our last episode of this season, so we will be taking the summer off and be coming back in late August, early September. But on the way to that, Father Dan and Heidi, welcome to you both. Heidi, how have you been?
I'm well, but I'm a little bit sad thinking about this being our last episode of the season. This is one of the highlights of my every 2 weeks is getting together with you guys. So yeah, I have a big summer ahead if we're not going to be talking to listeners before then. So I am excited to be having plans to cover the Democratic and Republican conventions, which are in Chicago and Milwaukee, respectively. And I'm thinking ahead to that, and we have some exciting family vacations planned, but not too much going on around here lately. I'm pretty excited about the interview that we're going to be sharing later on the episode, where I had a chance to sit down with Beth Johnson. Many people might know that I did a short biography about her a couple years ago, and it was just really good to connect with her and talk to her. The print version of the interview is at NCR, but we have the audio. And I want to give a shout out to a couple listeners who I've run into or will be running into. Our parish hosted an event with Network, the Catholic Social Justice Lobby. And who should sit next to me but Dave McNaughton, shout out to him, who tells me he's a Francis Effect listener. And that was a very interesting presentation about multi-issue voting. And then I'm about to go have lunch with a friend of the show, Ann Jenkins, who Dan and I connected with over in Assisi, Italy last summer. And I know she's a regular listener as well. So she said to say hi to you, Dan. So I'm doing it on air, so she knows that I did it.
That's great. Hi back to Ann as well. I have fond memories of our time in Rome and Assisi and to that great lunch that the three of us enjoyed in Assisi too. Feels very far from Assisi for me these days. It's the end of the semester, and so finals are coming up and final grades and final projects and papers, oh my. But it's also that great kind of transition time from the semester into the summer. And for those of us who are especially Catholic theologians, we have a lot of conferences coming up in May and June. So it's a different kind of busy. It's a move from the classroom to the kind of professional sharing, academic research, a kind of networking with colleagues and friends time, which is great as well. So I'm looking forward to that. Just one additional shout out. The last episode we had dropped on the same day, people may recall, as our 2024 Matt Oliva lecture. And our special guest on the podcast that day was the lecturer herself, Dr. Natalia Imperatore Lee. And I have to say, I know I'm biased as the director of the Center for the Study of Spirituality that hosts this lecture every year for the last 39 years. It was outstanding. It was amazing. She was on fire, and our students were just energized by her insights and presentation. I've heard so many positive things from theologians and from scholars and from people of all walks of life who watched it live or came and joined us in person. And I'm happy to say that the recording is available now online on the Center for the Study of Spirituality's YouTube page. You can find more information about that if you go to Saint Mary's, spelled out saintmarys.edu/spirituality. Learn about the center and find links to the recording. So I encourage you to do that. It's well worth your time. David, you've had a very eventful couple of weeks, even though you are on sabbatical. So you are not grating, but you are maybe grating in terms of physical pain. How are you doing, brother?
Thank you for asking. And I appreciate the well wishes and the prayers from listeners. I have been contacted by some folks who heard what I said at our last episode and were concerned. Just to say, I'm doing much better now. I'm right around a month out from the deep vein thrombosis event that seriously knocked me sideways. I have now reached the point where I'm no longer in pain. The swelling is under control. And starting this past weekend, walked about a mile and a half on Saturday, walked almost 3 miles, not all at once, but in some chunks on Sunday, took Monday off and really was wiped out from that. But then this morning was able to walk another mile and a quarter. And so I'm slowly regaining the ability to move and be in the world. And that has allowed me also to be getting back to the work that I need to be doing during my sabbatical. So I'm back to writing. I'm back to being able to sit up and do editing for long periods of time. But I do take breaks and move around. But it's just, there's a lot that has been going on, a lot of moving parts to get me back to health. And I'm still not at full health, but I am. Every day is a little bit farther along the curve. And not every day is progress, but I am getting better. And I'm grateful for all of that. And I'm excited for the transition into the summer. I'm excited to have warmer weather and the chance to hang out with the kids and have them be out of school. That'll happen in a few weeks. I'm not going to be traveling as much as I planned to do. There are some conferences that I'm going to have to say no to and bow out of. But beyond that, I'm really looking forward to everything that's going to be going on this summer. And speaking of looking forward, let's talk about what's going to be happening on the episode today. So in our first segment, we're going to be talking about the oral arguments that the Supreme Court had recently about a case that deals with the criminalization of the homeless. There's more complexity than that, but in a 30,000-foot view, that's what the case was about. In our second segment, we're going to be returning to an audience favorite. We're going to be doing a pop culture roundup where we're talking about what we've been watching and listening to lately. And then in our third segment, I'm really excited about this. Heidi has an interview with the storied and well-known theologian Elizabeth Johnson. So all that is coming up on The Francis Effect. Please stay with us.
Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm Dan Horan, and I'm here with Heidi Schlumpf and David Dalt. Every couple of weeks, we get together to discuss news and events through the lens of our Catholic faith. On Monday, April 22nd, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case of the city of Grants Pass, Oregon versus Johnson. Grants Pass is a town in southern Oregon with a population of 38,000 people. Among those citizens, approximately 600 are unhoused or chronically homeless. At the heart of the case is a set of city ordinances whose cumulative effect is to criminalize homelessness. Critics note that in 2018, then-City Council President Valerie Lovelace said the laws were intended to make Grants Pass, quote, so uncomfortable that they, the homeless, move on down the road, unquote. Amy Howe, a commentator writing on SCOTUS blog, notes that, quote, laws like these, known as camping bans, have been implemented across the country. To address its homelessness problem, the city in 2013 decided to increase enforcement of existing ordinances that bar the use of blankets, pillows, and cardboard boxes while sleeping within the city, unquote. During oral arguments, the justices were clearly divided in how they were thinking about the basic facts of the case. For example, Justice Clarence Thomas likened homelessness to drug addiction and implied that the city was justified in both cases in punishing unwanted behaviors that resulted from these conditions. In contrast, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson noted that the laws targeted activities that everyone engages in, such as sleeping. Justice Jackson suggested that the implementation of the law amounted to granting some citizens the right to sleep, but not others. In a column for Vox.com, Ian Millhiser noted that, quote, "Given the morass of competing concerns raised by different justices, it is difficult to predict what the court's opinion will ultimately say, although again, it is unlikely that Grant's pass will end in a significant victory for people who lack shelter," unquote. David, I know that homelessness is an important issue to you and your family, and you've been watching this case closely, especially as somebody who, as I like to say, is a keen watcher of that other SCOTUS, not John Dunn's, but the Supreme Court. What has caught your attention in the oral arguments last Monday?
Well, I've been thinking about this, and as I've been listening to the oral arguments and reading the commentaries, I keep coming back to a favorite hymn of mine called Love Unknown. And there's a stanza in that hymn that says, "In life, no house, no home did our sweet Savior have. In death, no friendly tomb, but what a stranger gave." And so I'm mindful, first of all, that we proclaim that God chose to be embodied amongst those that are at extremity, those that are in places of vulnerability, in sort of transitional states. And so I'm thinking a lot about how we arrange our civic structures to accommodate, be hospitable to, or to be inhospitable to the homeless among us. And so I go back to what that city council member said, that this entire set of civic ordinances was designed to push the vulnerable down the road. And unfortunately, a lot of the oral arguments, and you can imagine that it's divided along the conservative and the more liberal lines among the justices on the court. The more liberal justices were asking questions about neutral and generally applicable law, how this would apply to a family with a home that wanted to pitch a tent in their yard, or how if you fall asleep on a beach, would that be criminalized, or if someone was doing activities that we sometimes take for granted when we are moving in our city. And the more conservative justices, unfortunately, were asking questions that likened homelessness more towards something like addiction and treating it as something that could be criminalized, and that people who are citizens of a city or of a state, even though they don't have an address, that their rights could be very easily stripped away. And obviously, there's a lot of complexity. There's more than an hour of oral argument that we're going to encompass here. And so there's not a way to deal with every little detail of it. But the sort of large view of it is this particular case stands to create a real chilling effect on organizations that want to help the homeless, and a real chilling effect and real punitive measures against those that are living in the greatest extremity that we can probably imagine in terms of our civic lives. So those are my initial thoughts, but I'm very interested in what you all are thinking.
Well, as a city dweller, I'm very aware of homeless populations, and especially this trend of people literally pitching a tent and trying to live on public land in public parks. There is an encampment of homeless or unhoused folks living just a block from my home. They move regularly because the police try to move them a lot. And I'm not sure from my observation whether that's a particularly safe place for them either, although it seems to be an extreme decision to try to at least have some sort of something over their heads. So I think this issue that's being brought up by these laws of people camping, basically, or making temporary homes on public land is what's very visible to people, especially if they drive into cities. If you drive along Lakeshore Drive in Chicago now, you will see tents up and down the park because homeless folks are pitching tents and living there. But we've been doing a series of stories about homelessness at NCR over the past year. It was a grant-funded project, and I can provide a link to those stories in the show notes. But I've learned a lot about homelessness. And while there is a population of folks often with mental health challenges who are chronically unhoused and who in a previous generation would have been in some sort of mental health facility, which under the Reagan administration were all gotten rid of and emptied, a lot more percentage of homeless is people like you and me who are one paycheck away or one cancer diagnosis away from financial instability, and how important the issue of affordable housing or unaffordable housing, especially in cities, is what we need to be tackling. So it's disappointing to see that. I think this is something that's visible, and I get that the case has gone up to the Supreme Court, but yeah, I'm discouraged to hear about how it was discussed in the oral arguments, because I think it's missing the broader social justice issues that we should be involved in as citizens and as Catholics.
Well, that was one of the things I was thinking about, and I haven't paid as close attention as David has, but I have been reading some of the articles in the Times, and then the Daily last week did a kind of in-depth episode on the oral arguments, and it is mind-boggling. On the one hand, Heidi, like you were saying, we're looking at symptoms and not causes. And the causes are those things that are structural, that are systemic, that affect more people than people realize. And that until you're in that situation where you're unhoused or you are experiencing food scarcity or you are insecure in some other ways that the Catholic tradition says you have a right to as a means to basic human flourishing, like healthcare, love, shelter, food, water, clothing, and the rest. It's easy then to demonize, vilify, and write people off. And I think Clarence Thomas's remarks from the bench are really disturbing to me, not only the comparison to addiction, but even the kind of presumption of addiction as itself criminal, a lack of empathy, a lack of understanding. And there are lots of causes for that. I think the issue of those who are experiencing homelessness and who are unhoused is something that touches big and small cities and rural places alike. It is, as you said, Heidi, in a place like Chicago, the third largest city in the country, just so much more visible. But I think of my own local city here, the city of South Bend in Indiana, and there's been a lot of advocacy on the part of some people in the city to try to address this. One such not-for-profit program is called Motels for Now, which has received a lot of pushback from some politicians and government officials because it's the kind of NIMBYism. We may know that acronym, not in my backyard. So trying to find permanent housing or supportive housing for folks who need it, where is that going to take place? Where is that going to be located? You get a lot of pushback from folks who don't want to see this, right? Who want to make homelessness invisible, who want to criminalize and vilify people who, for a number of reasons, find themselves in this situation.
Well, I just want to speak personally from two different directions. We mentioned at the topper of this segment that I have had a long connection to homelessness. In 1991, my mother was evicted from her home. And so she lived in very tenuous housing situations for a number of years after that. And so I have had a direct impact of this. And because of that, as I have been involved in various Catholic parishes through the years, I have volunteered pretty regularly with homeless support programs like soup kitchens. And here in Hyde Park, my family and I have partnered with several families that are in sort of housing instability to help to support them through rocky points in their own journeys. The things that I've learned about how hard it is once you have lost housing to get back to stability and all the things that can go wrong, even and especially when they're going right. Again, there's too much of that to talk about in a segment like this. But just to say, I think we have a narrative in our comfort where we think, oh, if the person just worked a little harder or made a little bit more money, they would then be able to get back on their feet. But oftentimes, a person who is struggling right at the edge of homelessness discovers that when they begin to make more money, certain vital supports that they were depending on are cut off. And suddenly, they're farther back along the power curve than they were when they were homeless. This one particular family that I'm talking about, over the course of around 4 years, we watched in various cases where we would help them get into stable housing and they would lose some other vital support that would suddenly make it so that they were in a worse situation. We do not have a pathway out of homelessness, and laws like this make it incredibly harder for people to not simply to get back on their feet, but even to move from day to day with dignity. Dan, you were just talking about the ways that we as Catholics need to be thinking about this. Catholics believe that the entire purpose of a civic structure is to help the common good. And the common good includes the least of these among us, even those that we wish sometimes might disappear because they're inconvenient for our lawns, our landscapes, or our sense of selves. And so I'm deeply invested in this. And I'm, along with that commentator from Vox, I'm really worried about what is going to happen in the hands of a largely conservative Supreme Court as a result of these deliberations.
That point gets me thinking about a question that I find myself coming back to time and again around the subject, which is, but what else can be done, right? So it's clear that this Oregon town, its intention, as we shared at the outset of the segment, was to discourage people experiencing homelessness from staying in this place and moving on. Well, what happens when every place, if this becomes a statute of the Supreme Court, or this becomes a decision that's applied throughout the country, where, if there's nowhere to go, where do you go? I don't understand this. Is the idea then to incarcerate people? Is that the idea? If it's illegal, you get fined, you can't pay the fines, you get incarcerated? This is a genuine question, because that's the thing I kept thinking about in listening to some of those oral arguments, where I'm like, well, what's the alternative?
Well, this came up and was put very clearly to the counsel arguing on behalf of the Oregon town. And one of the things that was said repeatedly was that they were using these punitive measures to encourage people to do things like go into shelters. And again, it's a notion that somehow human beings are not dignified agents of their own destiny, but rather they are sort of materiel to be maneuvered in one direction or another. But that doesn't actually deal with the fundamental questions here. How can we help? And I'm again drawing from that UN speech that Pope Francis gave back in 2015. How can we be supporting these people in vulnerability and extremity in becoming dignified agents of their own destiny? That doesn't mean that they live the scripts that we want for them. That means that we work with them to help them to get genuine solutions to the problems that they are facing. And this is what we keep trying to short circuit.
Well, I can appreciate the underlying idea is to get people who are unhoused into a place where they have a roof over their head. I think it goes without saying that, first of all, many, if not most cities don't have enough shelter, room in shelters for the number of unhoused people. And many of those shelters are not safe or really realistic options for some people in terms of the rules and regulations that they have, the requirements, the being separated from their children, or whatever the case might be that they would choose not to go into a shelter. Better to me would be that they would be trying to move people into affordable housing, not into short-term shelter situations. And I do want to praise many Catholic organizations. I know when I used to work for the Claretian Fathers, they had many affordable housing projects that they were doing in parts of Chicago and around the country. Catholic Charities and many other places do a lot of work trying to make sure that affordable housing gets built or is created, and then to help people with a lot of the support systems that are needed to get someone into that. But I will say that it unnerves me and makes me concerned that the very same justices that were arguing for the pro-life view of unborn fetuses don't seem to care too much or have much empathy for the already born unhoused people on our streets. And it's this kind of conversation that people hear and then say, wow, you're not very credible when you say you care about women and babies, because you don't seem to care about women and babies who are unhoused. And I'm not judging the judges, I'm not judging their hearts. But if this is the conversation that they're saying in their oral arguments that doesn't seem to have much compassion, then that is another excuse for people to say, look how hypocritical those Christian and Catholic people are.
I just want to add to what you were saying about Catholic Charities and some other organizations. I think groups like the Catholic Worker, I know in South Bend, members of the Catholic Worker community have been spearheading the Motels for Now initiative and project. But I'm also thinking of some of the good work of Catholic moral theologians who are very concerned about this. And one title comes to mind by a University of Dayton theologian named Kelly Johnston. She wrote a book several years ago called The Fear of Beggars. And that has always stayed with me because is that not what we're talking about here, right? What is the fear of those who are unhoused? What is the fear of those who are experiencing abject poverty that no one wants to see them? They want to hide them, get them away, get them out of here, move down the road, as that one government official said. And I think at the core is something that David was talking about, which is it reminds us of our finitude, of our frailty, of our vulnerability, and that this could be us. And it's just really startling. I think one response to that is empathy and understanding and compassion, something Pope Francis talks a lot about, something Jesus preached. But another way is, as the Old Testament prophets often say, we harden our hearts to look another way, not our problem. Somebody else is going to solve this. And we blame the victim. So I know this will sadly not be the last time we talk about those who are unhoused, those who are experiencing chronic homelessness, those who are experiencing abject poverty or vilification because of their circumstances. So we ask you all to keep our siblings who are in those conditions in prayer and for justice to reign through the government systems that are responsible for that, especially in the promotion and protection of the common good. I think we'll probably circle back to this maybe in the summer when decisions are made. But in the meantime, you're listening to The Francis Effect, and we'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm David Dalt, and I'm here with Heidi Schlumpf and Father Dan Horan. Every couple of weeks, we get together to discuss a variety of topics from a perspective informed by our shared Catholic faith. Well, we've reached the end of the 14th season of The Francis Effect. We've spent the last few months looking at issues facing our nation, the highs and lows of church life, and some catastrophes around the globe. While we sometimes have exciting and positive stories and events to discuss, we often find ourselves engaging in difficult topics. As important as all those things are, it's also important to do a bit of self-care and even a bit of mindless distraction. So, as has become our tradition at the end of each season, we want to take some time to share what we've been reading, watching, and listening to lately in a segment we call our Pop Culture Roundup. Dan, why don't you get us started? What has been on your entertainment and pop culture radar lately?
Well, we were just talking off air about how lame we feel sometimes in talking about these things. Maybe that's why it's a fan favorite. Folks like hearing us talk about our weird tastes. I have a few things. Yeah, so one of the things I've really enjoyed watching lately is in the kind of mindless category is the comedy series Brooklyn Nine-Nine that Andy Samberg and company are behind. It's now on Netflix, like when Seinfeld went on Netflix or The Office. It gives you an opportunity to binge lighthearted, funny, not too serious sort of subjects. And so I've really enjoyed doing that. I'm also a fan, speaking of comedy, of Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm, which has been on for more than two decades, and enjoyed the final season, as I always have. It's funny, unlike Brooklyn Nine-Nine or The Office or 30 Rock or Parks and Rec, which I feel like I could watch indefinitely, Curb Your Enthusiasm, I have to take in small doses because the discomfort, the awkwardness, the uncomfortable settings are so intense. Maybe I'll say one more TV show that I'm watching right now that I highly recommend. It's a little bit more serious, maybe a little bit more scary, and that's The Three Body Problem, which is streaming on Netflix. So fans of science fiction, fans of mysteries, fans of physics and quantum mechanics, this is a show and a book series for you. So I've really enjoyed it. I actually just finished the last episode of the 8-episode season yesterday. So two thumbs up from me. What are you listening, watching, reading?
Well, I like Curb Your Enthusiasm too, and I haven't seen the final episodes, but I just want to say on the lame factor how I tried to listen to the Taylor Swift album and I just must be too old, or maybe it's just been so long since I've been through a breakup that I can't relate. I have a pretty happy marriage. So my daughter is more of the age for that, but she and I listened to part of it while we were in the car together on Sunday. I like it, but it all sounds the same to me. So all the haters can now start sending me the hate mail. I have watched some good TV shows lately and some series. And as I was jotting down some notes, I noticed that the two I wanted to talk about both have verses, the word verses in them. Huh. So maybe I like conflict. There's this show on PBS called Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. And it doesn't even sound interesting, but it was the number one PBS show for a couple weeks, you know, starting a couple weeks ago, and I'm a PBS member. So my husband and I watched it, and my husband knew about it. It's based on a true story about all these people in the United Kingdom who ran like little post office substations and how a computer malfunction made them owe a lot of money, and it devastated all these people's lives. The show is great. The acting on PBS is always so good, and I highly recommend it. And then, for fun, my husband did not join in this. I watched The Capote versus the Swans, so there's another versus, which I forget. I think it's an FX series, but then was streaming on Hulu. And just as a journalist, of course, I have admiration for Truman Capote's In Cold Blood and his writing and all that. But this was about him and his treatment and relationship with and feud among the wealthy society women in the 60s and 70s. And I thought that was quite good, too. So I've been watching a lot of things that are one group versus another. What about you, David? What have you been listening, watching, reading?
Well, so in our household, we are big fans of Aaron Sorkin, and we were late coming to a series of his called The Newsroom. And so just this week, we got done watching all three seasons of that. And I have to say, as a person who is a dyed-in-the-wool fan of The West Wing, who's a real fan of The Social Network and Steve Jobs and just thinks that those movies are and those TV series are wonderful, I really had some very mixed feelings about The Newsroom. It didn't land quite the same way that some of the other series of his that I've watched have. And it seemed like in a lot of points, he was either recycling material and jokes and lines or phoning it in. And it also seems like he really was trying to get a kind of vibe like The American Office had, a kind of Jim and Pam interplay that just never really landed. And so at the end of the day, the only character that I really liked from that series was Olivia Munn's character. She plays a character named Sloane Sabbath. And she, every time that she was on screen, I was like, yes, I believe this character. I get where this character is coming from, and I fully appreciate what this character is bringing. So I was basically the Sloane Sabbath fan club as we were watching this. It wasn't a bad way to spend my time, but Aaron Sorkin has done much better. We've also, as a family, just recently finished rewatching the Loki miniseries on Marvel. And I will say the second season of Loki, the first time that we watched it, I saw a lot of flaws. I really was a big fan of the first season of that series, and I was very skeptical of the second season. But when we watched it through again, it really hit me, particularly the very last episode just landed. And a lot of the things that I thought were ham-fisted before felt a lot more earned for me. So maybe if I ever go back and rewatch The Newsroom again, I'll have more generosity in my heart towards what Aaron Sorkin was trying to do. But first time through, it just didn't land for me. I haven't listened to the new Taylor Swift yet, but longtime listeners will know that during the pandemic, when she released Folklore, that was a real watershed moment for me. So I'm generous in my heart towards what she's trying to do, even if I don't always like every release that comes out when it first comes out. So I'm trying to be a Swiftie, friends. I am.
I heard a distinction the other day somebody made between being a fan of Taylor Swift and a Swiftie. And I think I probably fall into the former camp. And David, it sounds like you might as well, that we're not diehard Swifties. That's ride or die, but genuine and sincere fans of her talent and her writing. But Heidi, to your point, I don't think it's uncoolness or a generational difference, because there seems to be a universal consensus among the critics, at least, that this album is not living up to, maybe in the spirit of David's Sorkin reference. We can maintain Sorkin's previous catalog being really excellent, but when you have absolute sort of genius level work, when you come out with something that might just be okay, it kind of hits in a very different way. And so I've listened to some of the songs on the album. I can see where some of the critics are coming from. I'll just leave it at that. It doesn't diminish my appreciation for her other work. I'll say that. I've also listened to some of the tracks, though not the whole album, just like I haven't had the whole album of Swift's latest album of Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter. And I thought that was much, much more interesting. And I think playful in a way that I really appreciate the covers. And then actually the critical acclaim has been the exact opposite of Taylor Swift's latest album, that people have really appreciated what Beyoncé's doing, especially those that she's covering as well at times. So that's been interesting. One music note that I was very excited about, and I go back and forth about what my reception is, Billy Joel's first single, the first original song in 17 years, Turn the Lights Back On. And the day that came out, I immediately downloaded it and listened to it. And I like it, but I don't know. I think there was something I've always appreciated, Billy Joel quitting while he was ahead, having the kind of record, these 33 number one singles and all this kind of stuff, just such classic music that he could sell out Madison Square Garden more than 100 times by playing songs that he's been playing for 20 years. Yeah, I was thinking, oh, that's, I don't know. It's a good song, but it's not my favorite Billy Joel song. Have either of you listened to that? I know, Heidi, you're a Billy Joel fan.
I know. We went to that concert separately, yeah, but together in South Bend a couple of years ago. I haven't listened to it. I'm going to have to. And I just want to make clear that I am not denying the talent of Taylor Swift and Beyoncé for that matter. And I am not a fan of country music, so I'm not a huge fan of that album either. But I think they're both very talented and amazing women and artists. But it just doesn't gel with me. And sometimes I think I'm getting to the age where I'm stuck in my classic music that I like. I keep trying to sample the new music and don't always love it. Here's another thing I haven't done is gone to the movies. I tried to get people in my family to go with me to the movies over spring break and no one wanted to. I wanted to go see Cabrini, so that might have been partly why my kids were not interested in a movie about a saint, unfortunately. And I purposely avoided the Civil War movie because I feel like it's too depressing and too realistic or too close to home or something. Have either of you seen that?
I have not. And I just want to circle back to the Billy Joel thing. The first two albums I ever bought with my own money back at the Record Bar in Columbus, Georgia, they were Billy Joel's Glass Houses,
yes,
and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. I have been a Billy Joel fan my entire life, but I also was very pleased when he decided to just call it quits. I don't necessarily need for my rock and roll heroes to keep going into super annuity, as it were. And so I have not listened to the new Billy Joel single in the same way that I don't really pay much attention now to the material that Peter Gabriel is putting out, even though I am pretty much a fanatical Peter Gabriel admirer from back in the day. So I have distanced myself from some of these folks. As the punk rock band Husker Du once said, some things never change, some things stay the same, some things rearrange. One thing that I know for sure, your heroes always die. That's the way that I think about these pop culture touchstones for me. But to that point, I do listen to a lot of new music, and so I'm constantly aware of new stuff bubbling up from various indie sources. So nothing comes to mind that I want to shout about right now, except for a rocker by the name of McGee, who is doing some really interesting things with guitar sounds that really intrigue me. And somebody described McGee as the kind of Batman of indie rock. And so he like shows up in shadows and plays this music and then disappears again. So I'd put that on the radar, but I don't have much else from music to really be shouting about right now.
So I just got to say, David, you're warming my Billy Joel loving heart. I am a almost 41-year-old who loves Billy Joel, which puts me a little bit outside his typical demographic. But I grew up with Billy Joel. Parents are big fans. I think one of my first concerts ever was seeing Billy Joel at the Carrier Dome in Syracuse, New York. I love Glass Houses. It's such an iconic cover to the LP with Billy Joel standing outside in his jeans, kind of this low angle throwing a rock at a glass house. Such great songs like Don't Ask Me Why. Oh, man, what a great bridge in there on the piano. Anyways, that's a little bit Billy Joel nerding out for you. But I have the same sentiment. I think I love Bruce Springsteen too, but some of the albums he's come out with lately kind of hit or miss. And I was making this reference to the kind of negative reception that Taylor Swift's latest album has received by the critics to a friend recently. And I said, you know, it kind of reminds me of Dylan's Electric period. It doesn't deny the fact that Dylan is a Nobel laureate, but I don't know. Sometimes I think they're so big and so talented that things go off the rails. We all have hit or misses. That's fine. I want to circle back, though, to Heidi's point about the movie theater. I wrote a column some weeks ago making a case for returning to in-person movie theaters. I stipulated that I am very fortunate here in South Bend to be in a kind of economic context in which the tickets are fairly cheap. Again, concessions are how these theaters often support themselves and make money. And so those tend to be expensive, but the tickets themselves are not that bad. And I've really enjoyed going back to the movie theater. I don't go as often as I would like to, but I did see the new Ghostbusters movie in the last couple of weeks in the theater. And that was just so much fun. I think the reboot of Ghostbusters, Paul Rudd in that with the kids from Stranger Things and everything, it's just been really neat to see. And I saw on a plane ride, I was on a long plane ride coming back from Europe some weeks ago, and the movies had not been really refreshed. I'd seen everything that was on offer except for that movie Iron Claw about the brothers who are wrestlers. It's based on a true story, and Zac Efron is in that, and Jeremy Allen White from The Bear, and they got a lot of coverage because they did these crazy kind of workout routines and this sort of thing to look like these wrestling brothers in real life. And it was much better than I expected. I watched it and I found it very moving and incredibly tragic. It's a very tragic story. So that's one of those things where didn't seek that out. I wasn't looking to watch that, but I was glad to have watched that. And Heidi, like you, I want to see this movie Civil War, in part because it centers on a protagonist who's a photojournalist, and which is my previous life. And so, yeah, but it also feels just like a little too close for comfort given our circumstances. Has anyone seen the new Dune yet? David, are you looking forward to that?
That is not a science fiction franchise that has ever grabbed me. I was intrigued when David Lynch took a stab at it. And there have been some other attempts to get it on the screen, but this was not a set of novels that really ever were part of my life. And so I'm very much on the outside looking in. I've heard that it's an interesting film to watch. At some point when it comes on streaming, we'll get around to it. But yeah, I'm not going to go to the theaters for that.
Well, you could always use it alongside David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest or Stephen King's It to help build a house. These are massive tomes. What about, speaking of books, I picked up a book I'm excited about. I haven't really gotten into it yet, but Anne Lamott's most recent book called Somehow, Thoughts on Love. Very excited. I just think she is a master of prose. Her style is just so beautiful. I see Heidi. Listeners can't tell that she was freaking out there a minute. Have you picked it up? Have you read it yet?
I'm going to see her tonight.
Oh, my goodness. Cool.
Yeah, she's She's doing a presentation in the suburbs of Chicago, and a friend and I are planning to go tonight to see her. And I'm a huge Anne Lamott fan. I've read almost everything she's written. And I know she's been writing for the New York Times recently, and those essays, many of them about midlife or even older life, really resonate. And I'm super excited to see her. I'm like, oh my gosh, you stole my book that I was going to share. And I'm glad we share it, because I did, as I did last year, I was a judge for a Catholic Media Association book awards, and I had to read 21 books in 6 weeks or 5 weeks. It was, some were longer, some were shorter, and I can't talk about them. That's been my reading for the last couple months. I can't even talk about the categories that I judged, but I can just say there were some that were really excellent. So I was glad to be able to do that. But yeah, her new book Somehow is on my reading list. What about you, David? What are you reading these days?
So I recently picked up again Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and I'm working back through that for a couple of different projects. And it's probably been 15 years since I gave it a thorough reading, and I am learning from it again and grateful for it. I've been dipping my toes a little bit into some of the work of M. Sean Copeland, someone that I know is well known to you, Dan, and benefiting from that. And again, it's just been little intersections here and there with parts of books as opposed to sitting down and reading a whole book. Also, lately, I've been reading a really tiny book called A Third University is Possible. And the author's name is K. Wayne Yang, but he is publishing this particular writing under the name La Paperson. And it's a little, it's short. It's probably not even 100 pages. And it's a kind of post-colonial intervention. But I've been, for some of these projects, I've been reading some very pessimistic writing, and this actually is a very hopeful little piece that I have been buoyed by over the past couple of weeks. And so it has been in my bag in regular rotation, and I return to it again and again, first of all, because it's written really well, but secondly, because it, especially in light of a lot of things erupting on college campuses right now, it really gives a kind of hopeful take that says, yeah, we can use the technologies of the university not simply to oppress people, but actually to continue the work of liberation, and here's how. And I need that sometimes, so I'm enjoying reading that.
That's really interesting. I sounds like something I might like. I would say I've read a lot of really interesting stuff lately. I wrote a column about Bruno Latour's posthumous book, which is excellent. He's not as well known in English-speaking circles as he is in Europe, a French philosopher, a really interesting person. But I have to say, most of my reading is work-related. So I've got a lot of projects I have that are looming before me, and conference season, as I mentioned, is coming up. So it's often really engaging, exciting, at times difficult work. But I find that's why I gravitate toward Brooklyn Nine-Nine or some of these other media, is that I can turn my eyes off a little bit, my brain down a little bit. But it's always exciting. I like that. Heidi, you and I have the Anne Lamott wavelength. David and I have some similar wavelengths as well. We all have similarities and differences.
One other book that I just want to give a shout out to that I've read recently, I read it in preparation for an interview that I did for Things Not Seen. A neighbor of mine, Sister Julia Walsh, she's a Franciscan Sister of Perpetual Adoration. She has just come out with a memoir called Love for the Broken Body. And it is a difficult read in some places because she talks about some personal and medical stuff that is very graphic. But in and around that, it's such an amazing spiritual journey. And I was, again, really buoyed and uplifted by reading it. So I commend that to listeners to check out For Love of the Broken Body by Sister Julia Walsh. And so, friends, that wraps up season 14. And I just want to say to you, Dan, and to you, Heidi, thank you again for showing up for these conversations. I look forward to this every time we get a chance to do it. And I'm so grateful that you take time out of both of your busy schedules to make this possible. And listeners, I'm especially grateful to you for taking time to be with us and to listen to what we think about these important issues. When we come back from this brief break, we will be engaging with Heidi's interview with Elizabeth Johnson. I'm looking forward to hearing that, and I know that you are too. We will be back in late August, early September with season 15 of The Francis Effect. And until then, please keep us in your prayers and know that you're in our prayers. Thank you again for being with us.
Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm Heidi Schlumpf with today's guest, Elizabeth A. Johnson. Elizabeth Johnson is a sister of St. Joseph and one of the most prominent theologians in the United States, perhaps in the world. In 2018, she retired from teaching at Fordham University and is now Distinguished Professor of Theology Emerita there. Throughout her career, Johnson has explored theology through a feminist lens, and she has won a number of awards for her work, including the Graumeier Award in Religion for her groundbreaking book, She Who Is. She has also received the highest honor, the John Courtney Murray Award, from the Catholic Theological Society of America. Johnson is perhaps best known for the 2011 public criticism by the U.S. Bishops' Committee on Doctrine of her book, Quest for the Living God. Some of her other books include Friends of God and Prophets, A Feminist Theological Reading of the Communion of Saints, Truly Our Sister, A Theology of Mary in the Communion of Saints, and Ask the Beasts, Darwin and the God of Love. Some of you may know that I wrote about Johnson's own quest for God in a biography called Questing for God. I'm so grateful she's agreed to talk to us today about her latest book, Come Have Breakfast, which is a series of meditations on God and the earth. Welcome to the podcast, Beth.
Thank you very much, Heidi.
Well, I'm so grateful that you are willing to come talk to us. I know you are probably among our NCR readers best known for expanding how many of us think about God. So in your groundbreaking book, She Who Is, I know that you drew from scripture and tradition to argue that God can be described using feminine images and metaphors. Now, in this book, Come Have Breakfast, you're once again challenging us to expand how we think about God. And once again, it's grounded in scripture and tradition. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what are some of those ways to see God, especially God as creator?
I think that is a wonderful question, if I may say, because in truth, this is a God book, fundamentally, and God and the earth is a subject that's newly coming into theology big time, given our ecological crisis on our planet, but it's got roots in our whole tradition and in scripture as well. So if I had to say what I was trying to do in this book was bring forth an understanding of God as a lover of the earth, as one who delights in what's material about it. We have this old divide between body and soul or matter and spirit, but God is as creator, brings in an organic way, everything that's material, that's bodily, that's made of flesh. And that, of course, widens out to include ourselves, sexuality and everything, the need for food, come have breakfast is pointing to that. But then not just ourselves, but we are part and parcel of an entire biosphere, of a network of life on the planet. And we would not exist without taking in and giving out material from the earth and other creatures. It's a definition of what it means to be alive. And all of that is God's good creation. God creates it, loves it. And the way I try to explain, accompanies us through time because it's not over yet. Evolution continues. So the idea of God as creator, and we have to bring in the fact that God is still creating. It's not over. It's not 6 days or something in the beginning. It's a continuous creation. One of my students who cottoned onto this recently gave a lecture in which she put up 9 slides of new species that last year scientists had discovered. So life continues to evolve. And of course, we don't know exactly where the future will be, but God accompanies us through all of that. So a God of the earth, a God who's with us and through us and with all creatures on the earth, because God creates and loves. And so that's the idea of God. So that pointly, when we say, have mercy on us, if we really got that idea, our us would expand and it would include not just humans, but it would include other creatures, on and on. This to bring God into our own understanding of what it means to be creatures on earth is to enhance God as creator and lover in an ongoing way.
I love that. And I love how you talk about the importance of a God of relationships. So it has a relationship, obviously, with us, but also with all the creatures. Can you say a little bit then about what this means? Like, how does Jesus fit into the picture? And what do we think of as Jesus?
It opens up a whole new door for Christology, if you will, Christ. Because first of all, Jesus, as we read in the Gospels, was very tuned into the natural world and loved the natural. I saw a little field of wildflowers. They are insignificant in the grand scheme of things, but he saw in them something of the care of God for creation and applied it then to humans, as a wisdom teacher would do. I love the line where he says that God, not one bird that flies falls to the ground, but that God doesn't know about it. And that's Matthew's version. Luke's version said that God doesn't care. God cares for one dead bird lying on the ground. I think of roadkill, you know, that you pass when you drive. It's like God cares. It opens up, when you follow the teaching of Jesus, a tremendous just those few verses, a tremendous understanding of God's care for the world. But if you go further into what Christians actually believe about Jesus, that he is the human being in whom God's own wisdom and word became flesh, and we call him God with us or Emmanuel, then you have God connected with the material world deeply in incarnation. And when Jesus dies and rises again, which we're in the midst of the Easter season now celebrating that, it puts Jesus' death on the cross in solidarity, not only with humans who die, but with all creatures who die, every single bird that falls dead to the ground, with a hope also of something more. So the entire understanding of God and also then of Jesus takes on this a more ecological and holistic framework. When you start thinking, we're not the only ones. Our species, we've been very concentrated, anthropocentric on ourselves, but we are not the only ones that God cares about.
Yeah, and you speak about Jesus is caring about the material, about nature and about material things. This is where the title of the book comes from. And you want to say a little bit about that scripture reference? Because I think you might have told me as an aside that some bookstores were confused by your title and weren't sure where to shelve your book.
Now, my editor was saying they might shelve it with the cookbooks. You know? That phrase comes from the last chapter of John's Gospel. And it's the appearance of the risen Jesus on the beach to the disciples who have fished all night. And the John's Gospel said there was a charcoal fire burning there on which were bread and fish being cooking. So I'm looking at that, and I have for years that Jesus was cooking breakfast for the people who were hungry. His disciples are fishing all night out on the lake. I myself, in all my 82 years, have never heard a homily on those words, because the scene after they eat goes forward into Jesus asking Peter, "Do you love me?" three times to make up for the three betrayals. And so everything switches in that direction, the preaching, the spirituality of that text to Peter. And I say in the book, when you go there to the Sea of Galilee, there's a little church where this is commemorated. And I'm expecting like the Church of Jesus cooking breakfast or something like that. It's the Church of the Primacy of Peter. So I said to myself, of course, why is this? And I say, because of patriarchy. Because who cooks breakfast for most people of the world? Still, it's women. And so here you have Jesus doing women's work. And I think that's why it doesn't get great attention. In fact, when I've said to people, come have breakfast, who said that? 90% of the people you ask, they have no idea. And when you tell them it's Jesus, they don't believe you. So that's, but in my understanding, as I started working with this, I said, look how many times throughout the ministry, Jesus was caring about feeding people, not just crowds, but certainly the crowds, but also individuals. The little girl whom he raised up from the bed and said to her parents, give her something to eat. That isn't the first thing you would think most people would come say. But the material needs of people, all the feasting and the sitting with tax collectors and prostitutes and enjoying a meal and so on, to the point where he was said to be a drunk and a glutton. And in Matthew's gospel, Jesus quotes that criticism of himself. So that he enjoyed food, material food. And what struck me as I worked on this, the terrible situation of famine in the world, of world hunger. We can look now at Gaza, but when I was writing the book, the UN statistics were appalling as to where people were starving, and especially how it affects children and their developing brains and their muscles is a horror, especially because we have enough food in the world. So in the end, to me, the words, come have breakfast, they show the hospitality of God, that all should be fed, but they also have a prophetic challenge to us who hear those words. Make sure everybody has breakfast. And then, of course, all creatures included.
Yes. Well, I can tell you, as a mom, I've often reflected on how much of my job of parenting involves shopping for food, preparing food, making sure my kids eat. So to see Jesus as someone who makes breakfast, I think is really an expansive view for me because I didn't know about that scripture as well. I'm along the 90%. So thank you for highlighting it. Let's turn to the other creatures, as you mentioned, all of creation. So I think in this book, you talk about ways to imagine creation. For example, we could see animals and plants as our neighbors. And you also say that we need to have a profound conversion of mind and heart, or move away from the hierarchy of being. So could you explain a little bit what the hierarchy of being is and why you think we should be moving away from it?
Right. You find this in ancient philosophies, especially as it affects Christianity, ancient Greek philosophy. And it's based on seeing the world divided into what is made of matter and made of spirit, and valuing spirit over matter because God is spirit, and therefore whatever is spiritual is closer to God. That, to me, is opposed to the doctrine and the belief in creation and God is creator. But the ancient Greeks did not have that belief. So this is how they saw it. And when Christianity moved into that Greek and Roman world of thought, the early thinkers adopted that pattern. And so anything made of spirit was higher and closer to God in a hierarchy. And so at the lowest level were the rocks and just plain matter. The next level up were the plants, because they at least were alive. The higher, with more spirit, were animals. They had locomotion and they could move around. Higher than them are the humans. We have a rational soul, a mind, and a will in our body, they said. And higher than us are the angels, because they don't have any matter contaminating them at all. They're just pure spirits. So as I say in my alliteration there, we go from the pebble to the peach to the poodle to the person to the principalities and powers, all under the rule of the primary cause. And that is a hierarchy of being. In fact, that's what it's called. And it makes humans who were educated with that think that they are so important to God that other creatures are only made for their own use, for humans' own use. So other creatures only have instrumental value, is the technical word, rather than that they have intrinsic value of their own in God's eyes. It also leads to the idea that heaven is for humans only, that nothing else has a future in terms of God's creative care, on and on. The pattern that I was trying to work toward, and not a pyramid, like a hierarchy of being with humans at the pinnacle, but a circle of kinship, a community of creation with every, not leveling out differences, not saying we're all the same. Clearly we're not, but we are fundamentally interrelated with one another. And so when we care for the earth, it's not, oh, we up here are caring for all these creatures down there. It's like interaction. We need them as much as they need us to stay alive. And we care for one another as members of the same community. So it's a different model of how humans relate to creation. And it brings forth the ethics on a different level.
So I'm going to cut to the chase with this question, then. So does this mean that our pets, our dogs and cats are going to be with us in heaven in the afterlife? You're saying that creation is redeemed too, right?
Well, yeah, I'm not just saying that. You just have to read Paul in Romans. All creation is groaning like a woman in childbirth, but it will be redeemed. It will be enjoy the freedom of the children of God. I mean, this is a biblical theme, all right? It's not one that we've noticed or paid very much attention to. So to answer your question, will I see my dog in heaven, which I get asked a lot? The simple answer is yes, without qualification. But then you have to back up and say, you know, what is heaven? It isn't a place like you go to heaven, like you go to Paris or someplace. It's a state of being with God. As Pope Francis describes it at the end of his encyclical Laudato Si, that in the end, we will all be face to face with the infinite beauty of God. That's his definition of heaven. I mean, you can't describe it, but what is it so beautiful? But then Laudato Si goes on to say, and with us, every creature resplendently transformed will join with us in endless bliss. And so the idea is we're all going to be together. I had students say to me, will there be dinosaurs, or how will we all fit? But that, once again, is literalizing something that we just cannot imagine. But the fundamental notion is if God creates and loves all creatures and finds the earth and all of the cosmos good, this creator is not a throwaway God. When you love something, you cherish it and you want it to flourish. And that's all inclusive here, not just one species on one planet.
I'm glad that you not only agree that the pets are going to be in heaven, but you're grounding that in our tradition and from the scriptures. So
and you have to end on who God is, what it means to love. You know?
In this book, you don't shy away from some of the hard issues like suffering and death. And just despite God being a God of infinite beauty and infinite love, our life here on earth still involves suffering and death, and not just for humans. And obviously, we're seeing a lot of suffering and death on the part of the planet and creation as well. So why was it important to include those issues in this book about creation and God and the earth?
Because otherwise, we just become romantics. Anyone who deals with theology knows that one of the most severe issues is the problem of evil. Why all this suffering? Why all this death? Why good people suffer that shouldn't, if it was a just world and so on and so forth? It's a huge, it's an ancient and huge and ongoing problem. And when you look, first of all, for God, you're bringing God into the picture, it makes it more of a problem, right? You look out at the world today, as you said, so much suffering in the natural world. And what was really exercising me in this book was the problem of extinction of species, that like little flowers and magnificent animals that took millions of years to evolve are just being wiped out by hundreds and thousands. And we're just like ignoring that. The line that struck me, Jonathan Schell is famous for this, that death cuts off life for the individual. Extinction cuts off birth for a whole type of creature. So we're decreating the earth, if you will. We're stopping evolution in its tracks in some ways, and we're, how shall I say, robbing the earth of giving glory to God in its full created flourishing. So it seems to me we need to be in our prayer, spirituality, ethics, preaching, everything in the churchy that we do, rituals, bringing into view that we are living in an age of great dying off. And to me, that is a profoundly theological, spiritual issue. And it has everything to do with who we believe God to be and what God wants. So I think just to ignore that would make the whole argument I'm trying to make in the book, or meditations that get us to see this a certain way, would just fall flat because it would be unreal.
Well, and I like how you say that's so interconnected with how we see who God is. So that's one of the things I noticed when reading the book, is that obviously there needs to be an ethic as well. We need to call people to think about, to change their behavior, to challenge the consumerist society and all the issues facing the earth. But that it seems to me that there are a lot of people who are already doing that. And it seems to me that you want to ground this in the basic theological questions, like how are we thinking about God? What is the purpose of a human being? Why is there suffering in the world? So tell me why you think this approach is important, or is it just that this is your piece to contribute?
You know, some years ago, I gave a talk in a parish about this, and the pastor, who was a very good pastor, was there, and the church was packed. And when I was finished, he got up to say a few words, and he picked up the microphone and he sighed. And he said, well, the earth, well, I guess we'll just have to take up a collection. Nobody laughed. I was appalled. And I went home and did a big examination of conscience. I said, it just sounded to this very busy pastor with a million things on his desk to have to attend to and all kinds of difficulties with people in his parish to care about, that this was one more thing to add on that we had to worry about. He went on to say, next week, we're taking up a collection for the local seminary, the week after for the Pope's charities and so on. So we'll just add on a collection for the other. And the problem there is, I realized it sounded so extrinsic, like one more issue, rather than an organic unfolding of who we understand God to be and ourselves in the image and likeness of God to be, and the whole creation reflecting the goodness of God to be. That once you reposition ourselves as part of this community and we understand God's relation to it, then no, it's not something you just take up a collection for. And believe me, I'm not being critical of this pastor. I was criticizing myself, saying, man, wasn't organic. I didn't show the depth of where this comes from. And I quote in the book at the beginning, the wonderful line from the scientist Stephen Jay Gould, when he said, we need to forge a relationship between ourselves and nature because we will not fight to save what we do not love. And that's the level at which these meditations are operating, to fight to save because we love it, because it is our neighbor. Love God and love your neighbor. I mean, that's the heart of the Torah as Jesus taught it to us. And to bring the earth and its well-being into that fundamental dynamic of spirituality and ethics is where it could really take off and have a good effect.
Well, thank you so much, Beth, for having this conversation with me. And I'm so grateful. Again, the book is Come Have Breakfast from Orbis Books. It's Meditations on God and the Earth, and I can highly recommend it. But thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is David again. If you'd like to hear Heidi's complete interview, please go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/FrancisFXPod. That does it for season 14. Please have a wonderful summer, and we will be back with you in late August or early September once we get the schedule together for season 15. Thank you so much for listening to The Francis Effect. On behalf of Heidi and Father Daniel, I'm David Dalt, and we will be back with you soon. The Francis Effect is produced by Sandberg Media, LLC, and is recorded remotely in Chicago, Illinois, and South Bend, Indiana. It's edited by me at the William Adams Studios in Hyde Park on Chicago's beautiful South Side. The opinions of this program are our own and do not reflect the positions of any organizations with which we may be affiliated. We want to give a shout out to the Salt and Light Catholic Media Foundation. They are not affiliated with our program, but they did give us their kind permission to use the name The Francis Effect, and we appreciate it very much. Please check out their good work at slmedia.org. This show is made possible in part by our Patreon supporters, and if you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/FrancisFXPod. We appreciate it very much. Please follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Both of those are at FrancisFXPod, and our website is also FrancisFXPod.com. Please tell your friends about the show, and if you're here for the first time, we have seasons and seasons of episodes that you can go back to and listen to for your heart's content. We're so glad that you're here. Heidi and Father Daniel and I will be back in about 2 weeks. We're looking forward to being with you then. Thank you again for listening.